powerful, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of the soul and the spirit and of the joints and the marrow, and is a critic of thoughts and intents of the heart. All scripture is God-breathed and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God might be mature, thoroughly furnished unto all good works. Study to show yourself approved unto God, a workman that does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. Open the word of truth this morning to James chapter 4, and in your notes to the doctrine of materialism. All right, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God, and that is what we are here to study. With a recognition of the principle of inspiration, we recognize that God has inspired the text, has recorded it through the men whom he chose, and that we have in the original autograph something that is without error, that is a perfect revelation of God. And, of course, our job is to study these things out so that we might know God. That is the ultimate goal of all of this, is to know God, to have a relationship with him that transcends anything that this world has to offer. So it's time to make sure you're in fellowship, the sin nature being the chief enemy of Bible doctrine. This is the trends that you have that warp and distort things along the lines of your own ideas. And these can be very problematic, obviously, if not checked. So it's time to deal with that issue and then whatever else you might need to do so that you can profit from the teaching. Let us pray. Well, Heavenly Father, we thank you for the positive volition that you have assembled in this particular geographic locale, recognizing that ultimately in your eternal plan, you knew from eternity past who ultimately was going to make it spiritually, who would not, and the price that must be paid in order to maintain spiritual integrity and momentum in the last days, particularly during the period when the Laodicean church is dominant. We thank you for the living grace, the support that you provide so that we can live in the devil's world, so that we can continue to pursue the objectives of the truth, to glorify you as we go in time, and ultimately to lay up the great rewards which you have reserved for those that diligently seek you. We pray as we approach your word this morning that God the Holy Spirit will bless our thinking and continue to guide us in all the truth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen. All right, we are dealing here under the issue of materialism with a fundamental doctrine in some ways that plagues believers, certainly in our country, because there is so much emphasis on this. It is viewed as, it is so pervasive, in fact, it is viewed as acceptable. There are not people who generally will stand up against this because it goes against the very grid of almost all people out there who have fallen into this. And do not find this nearly as offensive as other areas of sinning, which before God, of course, it is. We're on Roman numeral 4 here, point K, materialism, dealing with the nature of the problem itself. We are not advocating, of course, that anyone should be poor or strive for poverty. This is not an advocation of a doctrine that if you don't have anything, you're ipso facto godly. That's not true. Or that if you have a lot, you are not. It depends on God and his blessing of the individual believer. So we were at point K. Materialism actually encompasses several problems. One, while the devil has a number of schemes he can use against believers, none is more pervasive or successful in the last days than getting believers to focus on the temporal issues of life. Two, his schemes involve getting the believer to focus on what he does not have. That is what worked with Eve, and it continues to work, of course, with some people today. And this immediately leads to the spiritual problem of discontent. And we are commanded to be content with such things as we have, recognizing it is God who provides these things, and that ultimately, as Job said, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. It's entirely up to him. Three, Satan apparently is further a master at stirring up the envy or jealousy grid within believers. This makes them focus on what other people have. Of course, it's what they don't have, maybe. And so they resent that. As per James 4:2, you lust and you do not have. And this concept of quarrels and strife and all of that comes from the lust grid, which is able, of course, to be manipulated in some ways by Satan, as he recognizes that the believers may struggle in this area. So therefore, it is an area in which he can work on them and be successful. You lust and do not have. so you commit murder. And you are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. Again, a fundamental problem with many believers is that they are focused on what other people have, what they don't, rather than acknowledging that all they should do is ask God. But for some believers, when God says no, they're not particularly fond of that either. And you ask and do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, so that you may spend it on your pleasures. And again, we would make a distinction here between the legitimate enjoyment of the things in life God provides through His grace and selfish ambition that just leads to pleasure seeking. And that is obviously forbidden here in the Scriptures and is something that God frowns upon. So four believers may wish they had what others have. Or they may wish others did not have what they have. That's the really stupid believer that looks around and says, well, if I don't have it, no one should have it. They begrudge anyone anything. There's a reverse form of discrimination that goes on out there in Christendom whereby some believers feel that they are spiritual simply because they are poor, that somehow this makes them better before God, which, of course, it does not. Again, external factors, age, sex, IQ, money, rank, position, all these things, none of these things commend you to God, or none of these things give you an advantage before God. None of these things give you a disadvantage before God. So you just have to figure, well, God gives me what He gives me. I'm not going to look around and begrudge others anything they have. And I'm going to be content with what I have, and that lifestyle is much more easy on the soul, for one thing, and keeps you out of a lot of discipline. So very often, other believers begin to begrudge others anything that appears to make them happy. There are some people who just live to be miserable. That is their sole existence. Misery becomes them, or at least so they think. And this is not a way to live. To be resentful and miserable all the time because of what others have and you don't, all of that. You've got your eyes in the wrong place. Your eyes need to be on doctrine and pursuing the godliness code, and let God take care of the rest. Five, the irony is that if some people spent time considering these issues, they might realize they do not actually desire that of which they have become envious or jealous. And so your neighbor puts in a pool next door to you, and so you want a pool because your neighbor has a pool. And then when you get a pool, you find out, geez, I never use the pool. It just costs a fortune to operate. And I have to heat it and I have to run it and have to run the water and all that, all the chemicals it takes. And then I realize, oh, I didn't really want a pool in the first place. Well, many people do that sort of thing. And they find out they never use what it is they purchased or lusted after so much in the first place. So if they would spend some time thinking about it and pause, I've thought about a lot of things in life I've wanted. The details and this and that. And most of the time, if I just pause and slow down and think about it and give it a week or two, I find out, I didn't want that as badly as I thought I did. But boy, in that moment when you want it and that lust seizes you, you know that I'm going to get it. And it'll make me happy for about 3 seconds. And then, of course, you'll have the bill to pay for it. So L, hard work and diligence, which may lead to material gain, is not in itself materialistic. In fact, the Bible speaks of these as parts of an honorable character, Proverbs 10:4. So some people work hard, but again, a good work ethic is to be praised, whereas some people, they work hard, but they're merely just trying to get ahead. They're merely trying to gain or sustain a level of living to which they have become accustomed and from which they cannot step back. And again, over the years, I've observed it is very, very difficult for people to step back once they gain a particular level of prosperity, to move into a less prosperous situation, and to give up some of the things that go with that material prosperity. So other people, they work hard because they are applying doctrine. They've just got a good biblical work ethic, and they recognize that God is for this. They're not doing it, quote, to get rich. They just recognize that this is a part of applying doctrine. So Proverbs 10:4, poor is he who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. And also 22:29. So God blesses the diligent person. Of that, the scripture is pretty plain. So we would encourage people to be diligent, not for the purpose of amassing a fortune or getting ahead or this or that, but for recognizing that God provides these things, and I can work hard and He can bless me And he blesses us on days. This is the whole principle of the seventh day of rest, is to show us that God can bless us even when we don't work, that God takes care of us under the principle of grace on the days when we don't work hard. And there's nothing wrong with having days where you don't work hard. I know that really goes against the American dream, but so be it. Proverbs 22:29, do you see a man skilled in his work? He will stand before kings. He will not stand before obscure men. And so the reality is that God blesses certain people if they are diligent with respect to whatever their calling may be in life. And everybody has a different niche. And none are more conducive, as it were, to divine good production than any other niche. The niche is just the niche. Well, the sinfulness of materialism has to do with two characteristics that distinguish it from an honorable work ethic. One, selfishness. The primary motivation of the materialistic person is to satisfy himself or herself, as we saw there in James 3. You want it so you can spend it on your pleasures. Not you want it as a part of God's grace and his blessing in your life. You want it so you can enjoy yourself, as it were, like the fool. Eat, drink, and be merry. You have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your rest. Enjoy your ease. And then two, excessiveness. The materialistic person pursues material ends at the expense of spiritual priorities, upsetting the proper balance and proportion God intends in the lives of believers. And there is balance and proportion to the Christian way of life. It's not all anything, as it were. You can't focus on any particular thing. This is one of the things I've seen over the years. People focus on one doctrine to the exclusion of all else. No, you have to blend these things together into a harmonious whole. Roman numeral 5 here, the dangers involved in pursuing wealth. A, the New Testament clearly teaches that wealth is not inherently evil. However, it also teaches that the desire for wealth can expose one to some significant risks, as per the passage we are studying or have just finished, 1 Timothy 6, 9, and 10. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation. Various forms of temptation out there. All these types of things that can come as a result of seeking to get ahead materially in life. All the compromises one can make. Again, no matter what area or realm they might compromise in, the temptation is there. And a snare, it's a trap. And the materialist becomes ensnared and entrapped in a lifestyle that is absolutely unbiblical in that regard. And many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. And so they end up wasting away, as it were, on the vine spiritually because they become materialists. The ultimate example of this, of course, is the Laodicean church, who focused strictly in some ways on the material and didn't give any real regard to the spiritual priorities of life, to doctrine and all of that. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil. And some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith. This has cost some people, ultimately it'll cost some people their crown. It'll cost them their eternal rewards at some level. Now whatever SG3 they may have accumulated through the years as they applied, God's still going to honor that. He's still going to bless that as per the Hebrews passage. He's not, doesn't forget those things. But the idea here is they become entrapped in this lifestyle. They wander away from doctrine. Why? Because this lifestyle leads away from the truth, not towards it. It leads towards the temporal realm, towards focus on the here and now, rather than towards focus on the eternal realm and those things which are above. And they have pierced themselves with many a pang, self-induced misery. And some of the richest people out there, some of the people that are the most materialistic, are the most miserable. They make themselves miserable through the pursuit of these things. God's not in it. God doesn't bless it. In some ways, they get frustrated with that. And so they have to work all the harder in order to get what God would give them willingly if they would just sit back and wait and apply doctrine. But that's too easy. We've got to do it the hard way in America. So B, in fact, Paul makes it clear that the potential for complete spiritual collapse is a very real possibility. See, warnings like these, unfortunately, have little effect on some believers at the practical level. One, some believers seem to conveniently define rich as a level of affluence above what they have or above that to which they aspire. Well, I'm not rich. Well, how would we define rich? And later on here, as we get into those who are rich in this present world, you'd be astonished at what just even the moderate standard of living in Florida is. And most of us live above that. Again, it's easy to say, well, I'm not rich, so this doesn't apply to me. Well, that is something believers have to stop and think about and determine, well, how does God define rich? As opposed to, say, how they define it. Two, some believers are more prosperous than those around them, but continue to pursue wealth or more details. Three, it seems that some, that should be some, are either not conscious of or willing to acknowledge their actual status. Now, if you're completely unconscious of who you are, that doesn't bode well for you. If you're completely oblivious to where you are in your life and to what God has blessed you with, and you don't acknowledge it, well, then that doesn't set well at all. Or they know it. They really know that they're well off, and they just refuse to admit it. I've met believers like that. Oh, poor me. You know, they'll have 10 times more than the people around them and continue to bemoan how little they have and how hard it is for them to live in life. And this is just so difficult because I really need more. And it's never enough, though. That's the whole problem. That's the whole treadmill with this thing. You run and run and run, and you never go anywhere. You just stay on this treadmill of pursuit of things that do not advance. For this manifests a condition in which the conscience becomes content to ignore the divine assessment of their continued pursuits for more. Most people won't admit, yeah, I'm out here pursuing more, more, more. I've got to maintain the lifestyle that I have become accustomed to, or I can't be happy. Well, again, it's very difficult for believers to take a step back. I've observed this in people over the years. Once they get to a certain standard of living, it's very easy to say, well, I've got to maintain that. And what if it's not, as per se Job, in the extreme? What if it's not God's will? And Paul set the example in this. He said, I've learned how to be to thrive and prosper, and I've learned how to go without. And so how did he learn to do it? Well, my guess is by going through it, that's how he learned it. So D, even though some believers have more than they need, some, many, continue trying to elevate their standard of living. One, when compared with the time in which the Bible was written, believers have so many more details now continually paraded past them. And I'm sure they had their big things in that day, too. Oh, everybody needs one of these. It's the Ronco Fishing Magician or whatever, you know, it might have been that they were selling, you know. Got to have one. You know, you need every Ronco device ever made so you can be happy. So, but it's a continuum now. Plus, now we have the added benefit of television, and so it's continually paraded past us, you know, all the time. Two, one irony is that few believers suffer from an accumulation of funds, since they are more eager to indulge the consumer lust that permeates our nation. The fact is, there are a lot of believers who are cash poor. They can't lay their hands on money when they need it, simply because they've invested it all in their money, in their details, their cars, their houses, this, that. And they live on the edge financially. And many of them just live paycheck to paycheck, even though they have a relatively high standard of living. They're only one or two paychecks from being in real trouble. And so you have to recognize that God has to provide this, and they're all too eager to run out and spend their money on that which does not satisfy. And the idea of a savings account for some people is just, you know, almost verboten. We can't know. If I saved, I wouldn't be able to have my boat or this or whatever it is they want. Three, the persistent barrage of advertising we endure, coupled with the fact that many things are priced within our reach, make it all too simple to convince ourselves that we really need this one more thing. And again, the believer has to, this is where you have to just be brutal with yourself. And is this something I need, or is this just a greed? Is this something I just want and I'm classifying it convenient? And children, again, are very good at this. You know, they come, Mom, Dad, I need this and such. Why? Well, everybody else has one. That's not a good enough reason to get it. And that is not a need. And so you have to teach children, really, from a young age. You know, you don't need this. And that's the joy. Generally, the dad gets to be the bad guy, because those of us who have raised kids know that, you know, and watched kids and observed them over the years, not just your own, but other kids, that they know Mom is a softer touch about some of these things. And, you know, Mom runs a little bit looser ship than Dad does, generally speaking. And so Dad's there to get to be the bad guy. No. Generally speaking, the answer is no until you can prove to me you need this or something. It's cold outside, Dad. I need a coat. Okay, well, now that we'll talk about. If you need a coat and it's cold, okay. Well, four, unfortunately, this leads to a situation in which the undiscerning believer plays right into the hands of his sin nature. He fails to watch for the signs that his affections are being diverted by his possessions. And for some people, their possessions have cost them their affection for the Lord at some level. And again, that is an overriding characteristic of the Laodicean period. They're not hot or cold. They're not out there fighting against Christianity. They're not involved in cults. They're not involved in doctrines of demons and all of that. On the other hand, when it comes time to apply, they're nowhere to be found. Why? Because they're busy working, trying to get more, trying to maintain that status of living. And so their affections begin to be diverted by their possessions, away from the Lord. And that's why he says, I'll spit you out of my mouth. I'll vomit you up. You're nauseating to me. But that characterizes, again, very much the nature of the dispensation or the time in which we find ourselves. The portion of the church age towards the end is very difficult, as we have seen. Everybody acknowledges the difficulties of being too hungry. Too few are honest about the difficulties of being too full. Philippians 4, and Paul acknowledges this, that there were times in his ministry when he had great contentment and great prosperity, and then there were times in his ministry when he had great contentment and no prosperity. So the contentment factor isn't based on what you have. That's the bottom line. Philippians 4:11. Now, not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. So Paul was, whether he had much or whether he had little, he didn't sit around wanting something else. It wasn't a concern to him. He was content with what God provided. I know how to get along with humble means, and I also know how to live in prosperity. Now, that's a real trick. Now, most people won't admit it. Now, it's pretty easy to live on a budget when you're broke. I've got $10 in the bank. What am I going to do? Well, nothing, because I don't have any money to do anything with. But when you have prosperity, then the test becomes, now, how do I handle the prosperity? How do I put my money to work? How do I use it? Well, I can spend it on myself. I've always wanted this or that. You can always think of something you wanted or something you want to pursue. I'll take a nice long trip. There's nothing wrong with vacations. We're not against vacations. Everybody needs a break and all that. So we understand that. But there were times, like the first 2 or 3 years we were here, we never got a vacation. We didn't go anywhere. We didn't do anything. We just got to live in Florida and work 2 full-time jobs. And that was fine. And there were times, and it was easier then in some ways, because, you look at the checkbook, and there really literally was sometimes only $5 left at the end of the month. And it isn't hard to determine what to do at that point. Nothing. Watch TV. We're not going anywhere. We're not wasting any more money on gas that we don't need to. So that in some ways, again, living in humble means is easy in some ways. But living in prosperity, that's a real art form, to not let it go to your head. And there are some believers, they have plenty, but they were more than willing to share it with you. And there are other believers, they have plenty, but you can be sure that it will be a cold day in hell before they're going to share it with anybody. And that's just the nature of some people. When it comes to money, they just do not want to part with it, as though money makes them happy. And that was one of the things I really had to work through in life. I mean, I was raised that way, and many of us came up during that period of the times where our parents had lived through, or seen at least, the Great Depression and various things in life in which, people didn't have much at all. And so they were very frugal. And it's been a real challenge for me to learn to just accept blessing and grace and, God's going to bless me. Because you grow up thinking you don't need anything, you shouldn't want anything. You were used to not getting anything. You got the one pair of jeans at the beginning of the school year that had to last all year, so you should be careful with them, which we never were. And then you ended up with the iron-on patches, on both knees and all that. And so then you realize, well, okay. So the hardest thing for me in life was to learn how to go out and buy nice clothes. You don't have to buy the top of the line, $100 shirts or anything, but I've learned, you buy nicer clothes. I learned this from other believers, from observing them and listening to them. I'd always buy, these shirts are 2 for $5 and worth every bit of it. And I'd always buy those shirts. And they didn't last very long. And you'd be out buying the new two for $5 shirts. Or you could splurge, you know, the idea of a $30 shirt at one time to me was anathema, you know, sign of the cross. And run the other way. But you recognize, okay, well, God's blessed me. I can afford this, and I'm not hawking myself to get it. And I found out the more expensive shirts last longer. They're better quality. They're easier to take care of. Certain people in my family don't like to iron. I won't mention any names. Whoever it may be. So I know how to live in prosperity and in every circumstance. I have learned the secret of being filled and of going hungry, of having abundance and suffering need. And so you can go through this, and you will probably go through these periods in your Christian life. You may have plenty. You may have nothing. It may be all you can do to pay your bills from month to month. I can do all things through him who strengthens me, the internal strength that comes from doctrine and the Lord himself. So Jalevers, that should probably be believers, should not seek a life of poverty. However, if believers understood or acknowledged certain realities, they might not seek a life of wealth. Proverbs 30, 8, and 9, which contains, I think, a good summary of the divine viewpoint on how we're to approach this. Again, the key thing is pursue God and let him pursue you with the blessings. Don't pursue the blessings. Proverbs 30, 8, and 9. Keep deception and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is my portion, lest I be full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be in want and steal and profane the name of my God. So the idea here is that just accept what God gives, and God knows what we need, and he's well aware of it. And will provide what we need. G1, critical danger of wealth is it tends to cause believers to focus on their money and details, while discouraging faith, rest, and gratitude. Proverbs 11:28. And so some people again are not content. They're not grateful. They have far more than other people. Have always had far more than other people, and yet it's never enough. It's always got to be more. Proverbs 11:28, he who trusts in his riches will fall, but the righteous will flourish like the green leaf. And then 1 Timothy 6:17, the verse we're not too far from, about to get to. And here the opposite attitude of conceit, which and trusting in their riches. But they're supposed to be fixing their hope on God. Instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited. Okay, what's one of the dangers of wealth? They tend to look down on people who don't have as much as they do. There's this sort of unspoken deal out there. And I've met some people who have money, lots of it, and they're not that way. And I've met other people, and it's very apparent that from the second you meet them, you're not in their circle or their standard of friends, and they know it, and you know it. And they let you know it. And so they tend to look down on people. They become conceited. And they fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches. Why? Because riches have wings. They can fly away and nothing flat. Particularly in our culture, they can. And they're supposed to be fixing their hope on God. And so they tend to not focus on faith rest and all of that. They're focused on what they have. This is my security blanket. Not God is my security. My money is my security. And that is inappropriate. Jesus addressed this issue of earthly treasures and how we are to relate to them. Nevertheless, some believers naively assume that even if wealth is dangerous for others, it's not a real danger for them. Matthew 6:21. Again, the believer that sits there and listens to this doctrine and says, well, this doesn't really apply to me. And I've seen people do it. Again, where your treasure is, that's where your heart's going to be. That's where your focus is going to be. And if your treasure's in the bank, you're going to be thinking about the bank or wherever you keep it. And also Matthew 19, 23 and 24. Here he tells his disciples, "Truly I say to you, it is hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. And again I say to you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God." And of course, the disciples are coming at this from all the wrong viewpoint, from the typical human viewpoint of their day. When the disciples heard this, they were very astonished and said, "Who can be saved? If the rich can't be saved, who can?" And looking on them, Jesus said, "With men, this is impossible. It's impossible with men for anyone to be saved. God himself, it's a supernatural act, but with God, all things are possible." And this was in the context, again, of the rich young ruler who claimed to want to follow the Lord, but when it came down to parting with his details, I don't think I can do that. So, again, some people believe, well, it's not dangerous for me. It's dangerous for all of us. We just have to acknowledge it. Okay, I'm aware of this danger. I'm not going to be blindsided by it. I can see it's a danger to fall into these traps, and I'm going to make it my concerted effort not to do it. Well, the pursuit of prosperity and the details of life has harmed believers and their moral character. One, material motivations and economic pursuits are currently eroding the qualities of character and virtue. We see it all the time in the political realm. They're all too willing to sacrifice and compromise and all of that. You see it in the moral character of our nation. What have we given up for money and the details? Well, almost every virtue that ever existed. Everything that was good in the world has been bought off at some level. Justice can be bought today. All you need is the better lawyer or the one that you pay the most. Too many believers have glorified the wrong types of people in this world. Those making the most money and enjoying the highest standard of living all too often have the worst character. And again, our athletes are a perfect example of this. Apparently, you can't play on some football teams unless you have criminal charges against you. And these are the people, you know, they sell their jerseys, the kids look up to. I want to be like him. No, you don't. And even the qualities of legitimate athletics have been eroded because of money. And people, they're looking for every edge. They're looking to cheat at every opportunity and not get caught. That's not sportsmanship. That's eroded the whole point of even physical contests. So one cheats and he wins. So what? Well, he gets the bigger endorsement. He gets to be on the Wheaties box. And so therefore, make lots of money. And many of these athletes, let's face it, they make way more money in endorsements than they make in their own chosen profession. Tiger Woods is a good example. He makes a lot of money golfing, but it pales in comparison. And I'm not saying he's a bad character, because he doesn't seem to be. He seems to have his head on relatively straight, I guess, as far as you can, if you're an unbeliever. I don't even know if he's a believer or not. But the point is, he doesn't seem to be like some of these other characters, the Latrell Sprewells and the Barry Bonds and these sorts of people who apparently don't have much regard for other people around them. So again, the people glorify these types of people. They look up to them. Children want to emulate them. Oh, God help us. That's where we're headed. Three, as Paul indicated, the love of money is a root of all sorts of evils. It is the unseen root that yields the immoral crops of envy, jealousy, violence, theft, bribery, immorality, murder, and a host of mental attitude and verbal sins. Four, consider the consequences upon the credibility of Lot for choosing to settle in Sodom, the root cause of which was primarily economic advantage. Genesis 13, as we saw when we studied this book years ago, Lot was looking to the here and now. Lot was a negative believer from whom Abraham was commanded to separate, in fact, and had not done so. But because of Abraham's weakness and he was ultimately positive, God worked this out to where a natural separation sort of occurred on Abraham's part. And he didn't just have to cut Lot loose, as it were. And Lot was all too ready to separate at that point, too, because he wanted the highest and the best. Genesis 13, 10 through 13. And here there was strife that came up in verse 7 between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's. Because both of them were very wealthy men, from verse 6. Verse 9, Abram says to him, "Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me." There's a spiritual separation here, but I don't know that Abraham even got it at that point. Maybe he did. But God had told him to separate from Lot long before he even left Ur, in fact. to separate from his whole family. Why? Because they were believers, apparently, but they were idol worshippers and religious reversionists. So is not the whole land before you, separate from me. If to the left, I will go to the right. To the right, I'll go to the left. And he left the choice up to Lot. And Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the valley of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go to Zoar. So Lot chose for himself all the valley of the Jordan. And thus Lot journeyed eastward. Thus they were separated from one another. Now Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled in the cities of the valley. And he moved his tents as far as Sodom. Now the men of Sodom were wicked exceedingly, and sinners against the Lord. Not if you watch the Discovery Channel this year, they're not. They were just misunderstood in some ways. Yeah, Genesis 19:14. They weren't misunderstood. They were well understood, in fact. These two angels come to Sodom, apparently just appear as ordinary human beings, as angels often did and the Lord himself appeared apparently just as an ordinary human being. There's no indication that there was anything special or different about them, because when Lot sees them, he invites them in. And before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house. Verse 4. Both young and old, all the people to the last man. From every quarter is not a good translation. It's down to the last man. This was not just some little sin that existed in Sodom on the side. This was something that the vast majority was engaged in. And they called to Lot and said, "Where are the men who came to you tonight?" They didn't say, "Well, these are angels," or they appear to not understand that they were anything more than just normal men. Bring them out. And as bad as it is that we may have relations, actually in the Hebrew it's "let us sodomize them," is exactly what they say to him. The good old Bible, you got to love it. So Lot says, "Stop doing this," etc., etc. And so then verse 12, the men said to Lot, "Whom else do you have here?" I.e., who else in your family? "A son-in-law and your sons and daughters and whomever you have in the city, bring them out of this place. For we are about to destroy this place, because their outcry has become so great before the Lord that the Lord has sent us to destroy it." And Lot went out, in verse 14, and spoke to his sons-in-law who were to marry his daughters, and said, "Up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city." But he appeared to his sons-in-law to be jesting. Good joke. Good joke, Dad. God's not going to destroy this place. Are you crazy? And look at this credibility. And look what it ultimately costs him. For all, and what's the bottom line root of this? Economic advantage. That's what he was shooting for. And what happened in his life? Well, consider the fact that his sons, consider the results of living in Sodom on the moral character of Lot and his family. Genesis 19:16. So the two men seized his hand, because Lot apparently wasn't moving fast enough, and the hands of his two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon him. Mostly, and partly because of Abraham's intercession for him. That was, again, the context of chapter 18, if you get into that discussion between Abram and God as to why Abram's doing this. He recognizes it's not right for God to kill this believer with the middle of these unbelieving reversionists out there. And they brought him outside the city. And then verse 30, of course, and Lot went up from Zoar. Well, of course, he lost his wife in this deal. Verse 26, and his wife from behind him looked back. Why? Because her heart was still in Sodom. What a place. Be like, I wish I left my heart in San Francisco nowadays, I guess. No, thanks. Pass. Certain cities are known for certain things, unfortunately. And Sodom didn't get its reputation by accident. And so his wife looked back, and she became a statue of salt. And pillar. She wasn't turned into a pillar. I mean, she was still looked female. She was a statue. And God judged her. And then verse 30, and Lot went up into Zoar and stayed in the mountains, and his two daughters with him, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar, and he stayed in a cave, he and his two daughters. Then the firstborn said to the younger, "Our father is old, and there is not a man in the land to come in to us after the manner of the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and let us lie with him, that we may preserve our family through our father." Fun, fun, fun. And why? Why is Lot in this position? Why are his daughters in this position? Because he chose to pursue money. And people don't see where this could end up. And the Bible makes it very plain. This is where it could end up. Things that are beyond, you know, unspeakable in some circles and should be. So they get their father drunk that night and have sex with him. That's great. That's real encouraging. And then they do it two nights in a row. So these were pretty, you know, I guess perceptive girls, I suppose. But they wanted children, wanted to maintain the family name and all that. Didn't trust God, so this was their STA plan. Where do you think they learned this type of thinking? In their home. If you have to compromise to get a big deal, it's not that big a deal. That was what they'd learned from their dad. Compromise and get it. So, you look at this, you look at the moral character of Lot and his family at the end of all this, and it's horrific to even think about. For a good example of the consequences that covetousness has upon a person's character, simply consider the inner character of Judas Iscariot, John 12:6. Now, we recognize Judas was an unbeliever and not a believer. And in some ways, to put this in perspective, Judas might get a bad rap here because when you compare the parallel passages to this one and the synoptics, the other gospels, Judas wasn't the only one thinking this. There were a lot of people grumbling and mumbling and murmuring. Judas just happened to be the one to step up and say it because he was the one who was the most covetousness probably of all of them. So Mary took a pound of very costly perfume, verse 3, of pure nard, and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples who was intending to betray him, said, "Why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" Now, he said this not because he was concerned about the poor, but because he was a thief. And as he had the money box, he used to pilfer what was put into it. So 300, and that's a year's pay. Well, that will take care of Judas for quite a while, of course. And so you look at his character. Again, primarily motivated by money. This is what tripped his trigger. Jay, it has done harm to divine institution number 2, marriage and the family. 1, for the rewards of wealth and the details. Many husbands and fathers are expending themselves so completely on their careers that they have little, and in some cases nothing, left to give to their families. 2, significant, well-rounded male leadership in the home is rare. That's why we see this big increase in the last days in horsey women. Because there aren't any real men out there to check them. And then when they run across a real man, I find myself butting heads with more women than you might think. Because they're not used to having a man they can't push around. And they meet me, and they think, well, he's just like any other man. I can push him around. I'm used to having my way. I'll get my way with him. And then when they find out they can't, it creates conflict. And, of course, it's all my fault because I won't be pushed around by a horsey woman. No, absolutely not. And in some cases, you got men that have turned into nothing but wimps who go out and they make their living, they write the checks, and they have no say-so in their own household. I won't live that way, ever. And no real man should. God put the man in charge for a reason. And we have an entire society where men have forfeited their authority, have forfeited their position and all of that, and just let the women call the shots. The woman runs the checkbook. The woman pays the bills. Well, I can tell you, in whatever family, whoever runs the checkbook pretty much runs the family. Money is a determining factor in these things. And so, and some men, of course, because they are such wimps, they just slough off their responsibilities to their wife and call it God's will. Well, God, you know, I can't make a budget and live on it, so I'll make my wife take care of it. Well, that's pathetic. What kind of a man are you? And so many men, again, have given themselves to gaining and maintaining a certain standard of living. And so where are they when the kids need them? Well, they're not to be found. A kid has some, you know, and I recognize today it's excessive. You know, they have graduation every year for every age now. You graduate from kindergarten, you graduate from first grade, second grade, third grade. And some of these school things have become excessive and oppressive, in my opinion. I mean, so when they get to 12th grade, well, this is the 12th time I've graduated. Well, big deal. So what? It doesn't tend to mean anything. It's cheapened the whole idea of even successfully completing high school. So again, men aren't in the home. They aren't available for certain things. Why? Busy making a living. Got to get ahead. The physical toll, point three, often means they have little left emotionally, physically, or spiritually for their families. Four, this is foolish since every believer should recognize the Bible is very clear on the fact that the sin nature is never going to be satisfied. Proverbs 27:20. So no matter how much you get, no matter how hard you work, no matter what level of prosperity you achieve, you'll never be satisfied. That's good to know. So I get to look forward for 10 more years of the same? Well, thank you. May I have another? A pass. Not interested. Proverbs 27:20, Sheol and Abaddon are never satisfied. Nor are the eyes of a man ever satisfied. There's always something he's going to see that he wants. Something that's going to trip his trigger, as it were. And Proverbs 30:15. I love this one. The leech has two daughters. Give, give. There are three things that will not be satisfied, four that will not say enough. Sheol and the barren womb, earth that is never satisfied with water, and fire that never says enough. And people have raised leeches for children. Well, what have you got? I've got two leeches. And what do they say every day? Give me more, give me more, give me more. It's never enough. I'm never satisfied. Whatever I have, I want more. And Ecclesiastes 1:8, where Solomon bemoans the wearisome nature of the repetitious nature of life. This he says again, as a believer, Solomon's not approached them and said, well, Ecclesiastes is written from the point of view of the unbeliever. That's not true. It's not true at all. He mentions God repeatedly throughout here. And he acknowledges God throughout here, that God did certain things. He recognizes that God has afflicted him with this task of wisdom, even. But he also recognizes the endless cycles of life, the repetitious nature of it. You get up every day and you go to bed. I mean, if you think about it very long, it will depress you. I get up. I go to work. I come home. I pay bills. I go to bed. I eat in between sometimes. And I'm going to get up tomorrow and do it again and again and again. If you think about that very long, I mean, you just put a bullet in your brain. I mean, how satisfying is that? Well, it's not satisfying at the human viewpoint level. But if one sees a greater issue going on, I'm not just getting up in the morning. I'm getting in fellowship. I'm producing divine good. I'm laying up rewards for the future. I'm focused on what's actually happening, not just the physical repetition I'm going through every day. And so he says, all things are wearisome. Verse 8, man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear with hearing. That which has been is that which will be. That which has been done is that which will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. And people, again, they think they've, you know, achieved great things and all of that. But if you reduce things to their simplest level, in many cases, it's just the repetitious human activities of life that are going on today, just like the repetitious human activities of life were going on 1,000 years ago and 5,000 years ago. It's just in a different format. It's just in a different form. Greater technology, greater details and all of that. And we work in different realms, but it's still the same. I mean, has music not been a constant throughout all of this? Pretty much. Music came from the earliest times of man. And in every generation, they probably had their hit songs, their Dick Clarks, as it were. All these things, this doesn't satisfy. It's repetitious. You do it over and over again. So, again, five here. Now, what kind of values are believers passing along to their children when the life is spent gaining and maintaining material things? Well, kids aren't stupid. And they figure out what mom and dad are doing. And they figure out what mom and dad's priorities are. Even though mom and dad may say something different. I mean, it didn't take me long as a child to figure out, why do we have to go to church? Well, we want you to go. Well, you and dad don't go. So why should I go? And then, of course, you get the famous, because I said so. And you put on your little Sunday school outfit and you go to Sunday school. Me, I wandered down to the Methodist Church, you know, learned little songs, memorized a verse or two, but never heard the salvation message. So, six, when believers pursue the material, they can easily undermine what they say about doctrinal matters being the most important things in their hearts and lives. And when they're inconsistent in Bible class, again, I'm preaching to the choir now, but the reality is that people are very inconsistent in Bible class, and they think it doesn't affect them spiritually. And it does. And it shows where your priorities really are. Well, you know, you can tell your child, well, God's important, you should serve God. And then they see that, well, you only serve God, say, a quarter of the time. Well, as one person put, too, and I think it's very true, what we allow in moderation, our children will excuse in excess. So if the parents only serve God a quarter of the time, well, the child's going to find out, what's the point of even doing that? If God's no more important than 25% of your time, then why should I consider him to be important? And the child will quickly figure out that this is all just talk. This is all just lip service. They're not interested in God. They're interested in doing their own thing and calling it God's will. And kids aren't dumb. So seven, believers should be aware that children do not need and will not get everything they desire. What they do get will be obtained by working, not by whining and manipulating. Proverbs 30:15. Oh, again, that's the one we've already read. Give, give. Whine and manipulate. But I can just hear Cartman on South Park. But Mom, I need some cheesy poofs. And I need this new game. I need this. I need that. And Cartman's a perpetual whiner. And his mom finally always just gives in to him because you get sick and tired of hearing it. And so that's when we taught our kids very early on. We're going to tell you no once. Don't ask twice. There will be repercussions. And when we say no, we mean no. Don't try to whine and manipulate and cajole. Don't go ask your mom behind my back. I'll find out. And don't. If she tells you no, don't come to me. And so parents have to set a very unified front in all of this, of course, and maintain this, you know, no, you're not getting your way by manipulating or by going around and cajoling or whining or whatever it is you do. And kids will try it. And kids figure out pretty early on that the way to go about it, and especially if they see mom doing it to dad all the time. You know, honey, you're being unrealistic. I need this. God wants me to have this Escalade. It's clearly his will. And so, you know, you can't settle for anything less. And they see mom whine and manipulate and get her way. Guess what they learn works? Particularly the younger girls learn it, that it works. And so they try to whine and manipulate guys and use whatever power they have. Well, Kay, in some cases, financial applications of doctrine have suffered from the wrong material priorities. One, the pursuit and acquisitions of the details of life can only provide momentary stimulation and happiness, while the true blessings of God actually satisfy the soul. Psalm 145:16. And we get into issues, serious issues of metaphysics and discussions of reality, of what is life? What constitutes life? What is real life? Life is a very complex thing that almost resists definition. But yet, we know what biological life is. We know if a dog is alive or if it's dead. We know what physical life is. We can see it in people. But what is real life for human beings? For believers, what is real life? And it isn't just what they can have at the soul level. Some unbelievers out there can enjoy a fairly good measure of what we would call life, a productive life, a happy life maybe at some level. They find the right woman. God blesses that divine institution. They get married. They live happily ever after. I mean, you've seen these stories on television. How long have y'all been married? 55 years. How did you do it? You know, it was always, you know, patience and a sense of humor, mostly. That's about the only thing that'll work. But they enjoy a certain soulish pleasure in life. They sit together and they hold hands and they watch the sunset, like on Golden Pond. But is that all life is? Or is there more to life than that? And so then you get into the spiritual aspects of life. And because we're, again, we're a big mass of all kinds of things that go together to form a unified whole. What is your life all about? What is your life, in fact? So Psalm 145:16, you do open your hand and do satisfy the desire of every living thing. And the provision of God is satisfying. Proverbs 13:25. The righteous has enough to satisfy his appetite, but the stomach of the wicked is in want. Again, the righteous would signify the positive, adjusted believer at some level. The wicked, the other extreme, the negative unbeliever, who's out there, God's real enemy, and God's not for him at all. Isaiah 55, also 1 through 3. Ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. And you who have no money, come, buy and eat. Come, buy milk and wine without money and without cost. Why do you spend money for that which is not bread? And why do you spend your wages for that which does not satisfy? Listen carefully to me and eat what is good, and delight yourself in abundance. Incline your ear and come to me. Listen that you may live. And I will make an everlasting covenant with you according to the faithful mercy shown to David. And in his context here, he's using physical material things and the satisfying of desires to deal with the real issue of spiritual salvation and satisfying the ultimate desire of a soul. And that is, deep down, for those who are positive, the goal is to know God. And he says, you can have all these things freely. I offer them freely. There's not a charge for this. Grace comes to you freely. And salvation comes through grace. But he uses these physical realities to demonstrate that while physical things satisfy the physical body, there are things that need to satisfy the soul and the spiritual nature of man. And again, that spiritual nature is regenerated at the point of salvation. All right, our time's up. Let's go ahead and take our normal 20-minute break, and we will continue on here in our second session.